out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 23rd of October 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. Well, I don't know whether to apologise for this or to celebrate this. In actual fact, Caroline Yeager was unable to pre-record her podcast yesterday, which means we do have time to have an interview with Mr. I, who has very kindly said that he will join us today after we had technical difficulties yesterday. So as I am so pleased to welcome back to the show, Mr. I, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Yes, doing
excellent.
Fine.
Excellent. And we've had listeners asking about what your early years were like and what life was like in the village and how it was that you learned all this stuff at such an early age. So I was hoping maybe we could go into some of that today.
Yes. Well, the 1930s were my formative years. And in those days, Britain was the leading world power, and that was something that people generally took a pride in, and especially the Navy with its reputation for Rule Britannia ruling the waves. And for myself personally, living near to Aldershot, which was the headquarters of the British Army, there were two events, annual events there, that reinforced the patriotism. And that was the horse show that was held in the summer. That was a very colourful affair because of the cavalry in those days. And we always had one of the Indian regiments appearing there. Now, I can't say that I ever saw the most famous of all, the Bengal Lancers, but others were there. And of course, to see these magnificent horses and the training and the coordination between the man and his horse, and that was up till 1935. When the theme of the tattoo was the farewell to the cavalry when it became mechanized. And I recall that at the end of their normal performance, the trumpet major blew the charge, and they all turned in a half moon shape and galloped towards the stand. And it was just like thunder, the horses' hooves beating on the turf, kicking up stones and all that behind them. And I thought, you know, the poor chaps who were standing in the square that was formed by the infantry to defend themselves against the cavalry, I don't think I would like to have been in one of those. And it was rather odd because charging towards the stand, the people in the front row started to get up and move back. And then, of course, it ended by the armoured cars coming in. And they were awful things. They were all riveted, solid tyres. Their top speed was about 15 miles an hour. And all smoke and fumes and backfiring. And because the uniforms were changed to the to a blue overall and a black beret instead of their colourful cavalry ones. And their awful smoky, backfiring, solid tyres, riveted, armoured cars. Of course, later on, they were amalgamated into the general sort of tank corps, but that was to come later. This was the their first efforts at deploying armoured cars instead of cavalry. So that was very interesting to watch.
That must have really been something to see those horses charging like that, as you say, with the noise, the thunderous noise, and all the stones and the turf
being kicked
up. I mean, that must have been terrifying for the enemy at the time.
That's right, because the defence the infantry made was to form a square and sort of concentrating their fire. But when you think that their armament in those days was a rifle with just one shot, not a machine gun or anything like that, which of course, and then the advent of machine guns in the First World War put paid to cavalry anyway, when it developed into the trench warfare. So, that was a shame, really, to see that happen. And, I only ever went to the one in daytime, but they had an evening performance as well, where they would have mock attacks from aircraft. But I could see, as we lived in the village near to Rushmore Arena, where it took place, I used to stay up at night and look out our landing window, and I could see the searchlights and the planes being caught in them, because they were biplanes. And talk about aircraft, I can remember seeing the R-100 airship flying over Farnborough, which is another little place nearby, and on structural stability tests with a small biplane flying around it. They were huge. They talk about jumbo jets today, but the airships were huge, and that's why they called them airships. The R-100 was was made by private aircraft companies, whereas the R-101, which crashed on its way to India, was the one made by the government. The R-100 made several very successful flights to Canada and back. And it's incredible to think now that they actually had a promenade where people could walk around, just like it was on a ship. You could walk on the promenade. And they also had individual cabins. They also had a dining room. And it's hard to believe they also had a smoking room for gentlemen. When you think of all the high explosive gas that was just above them. very interesting. Of course, they didn't actually land on the ground. They were moored to poles. Some of you have seen the photographs, and indeed the newsreel of the Hindenburg, the German one that caught fire as it was coming into land at its mooring pole in New Jersey. And there was a bit of a mystery behind that, why it should suddenly have caught fire, because there had long been agitation by the Jews of New York to have this this thing with a large swastika painted on its tail, flying over them. So there's always, well, certainly in my mind, but then I've got a suspicious mind, that it was probably arson, a bomb planted on board or something like that.
Wow. So at the time there was complaints from Jews about this particular airship.
Yeah, because as you know, New York, there's more Jews in New York than there are in Israel, even to this present day. Their community there. So there was always that suspicion that it was sabotaged. And it was famously recorded by one of the American radio stations. Farnborough became, of course, nowadays it's the Royal Aircraft Establishment. And that came about because the site of the airfield was called Laffan's Plain, which was the headquarters of the Royal Engineers, and where they did all their work, like digging trenches and that. And of course, they started off experimenting with manned kites for observation purposes, and then balloons, sending men up in balloons when radio was invented. So they could observe movements at a greater distance. And of course there was the famous Colonel Cody, Buffalo Bill, who used to fly there, and then it, as I say, it developed into the Royal Aircraft Establishment. And one of my mother's cousins was engineering officer or something like that, and I went up there and was allowed in, and at that stage they were experimenting with a catapult to fire amphibious seaplanes off of ships. that was an interesting thing. See, this aircraft being fired off on the catapult. Of course, that was a very dangerous thing, that they had to have the engine running at a certain speed, that when they left the catapult, they would actually remain airborne.
Wow. Yeah, wow. You're using
interesting place to live.
Yeah, I bet. I bet, and that old technology there of the slingshot, and still using that last century for updating it for aviation.
The big shock came with the Depression, and that really shook people's confidence to some extent, because we thought, well, we're well off as a country. And then they found that we suddenly couldn't keep men in employment, and of course that led to a great upset in politics. Was it Stanley Baldwin's government? Anyway, he was appointed a minister with a portfolio to study the employment situation, and when he submitted his proposals, the Chancellor of the Exchequer said to him, the city wouldn't stand for it. And of course that led Mosley to leave the Labour Party, set up his own party, which he called the New Party, but they couldn't get anywhere. So eventually he turned to form it into a fascist movement, and which really shook up the establishment. And well, I must say he tried his best both to put the economy back on track and to prevent the war. An interesting thing is Michael Foot. He was a leading Labour Party politician, and he had the grace to say what Mosley so valiantly stood for could have saved his country from the Hungry 30s and the horrors of the Second World War. So afterwards, people were forced to admit that Mosley was right. But of course, too late then.
That's amazing that Michael Foot was willing to say that and speak up for for Mosley.
Yeah, he was. Actually, he was an MP for Plymouth, and he was a leading light in the Labour Party, and although he didn't support Mosley at the time, in retrospect, he could see that Mosley was right, and the terrible consequences of ignoring what Mosley stood for.
He could have prevented the war, and
the
also
the British Union is another story, which I'll have to look into and make a broadcast about that, I think, because there are some really interesting characters in there. Yeah.
Excellent. Do you want to talk a little bit about the bakery? And because you were telling me the other week about how people would drop by the bakery and you would learn things at a young age about what was happening around you politically.
My father owned the village shop and the bakery. Of course, in those days, people tended to use a shop as the meeting place during the day, like the Fox and Hounds public house was the meeting place in the evenings. Because I used to sit on a little corner shelf and listen to all what was going on. And it was, the men, of course a lot of them were agricultural workers, and they were hardly hit very hard by the recession. And I mentioned in the previous broadcast the friend of my father's who was a veterinary officer who served in the First World War and stayed on for the British Army of Occupation in the Rhine until the Germans took it back in 1935. And the way that you could tell, of course, there was no television then, and you could tell that people didn't even have radios because of the way they pronounced things, like the Maginot Line instead of the Maginot Line, and the Third Reich instead of the Third Reich. And people's names they would often mispronounce because I'd only seen it in writing in the newspapers. Yeah. And although actually the shop, we didn't sell newspapers in the shop, but we always had a selection on the counter. And we used to come in and read it, especially the racing columns, I might say. And that was where I became acquainted, as it were, to the political situation and what was going on in the country. Yeah.
Was the fellow who was stationed in the Rhine, was he there at all for when the National Socialists were in power? Did he get any experience of that?
He said how well the Third Reich compared with the corrupt, decadent Weimar Republic. And of course, it certainly did. And I mentioned the dreadful unemployment and that in Britain, but in Germany they had 6 million in 1933 when Hitler came to power. They had 6 million unemployed, and without borrowing any money abroad, through their own efforts, they reduced that rate by 1 million a year, and by 1939 they had full employment. Now, people say, oh, well, that's because he started building tanks and aircraft and that. But that wasn't so. No, it was just getting the country moving again. And, of course, the people, now they had sufficient income, they wanted consumer goods. So it wasn't built on a rearmament plan. It was rebuilding industry in general, and the people they wanted consumer goods that they'd been starved of during the Depression years.
So they built more of those. So they built up the infrastructure, and the people got employment through that and got good wages through that. And then because they then had the wages to afford consumer goods, there was a need for these consumer goods, which provided more jobs. So
that's right, yeah. And of course, once that happened, the industry boomed as well. And at the start of the war, they found it difficult to get the armaments. But of course it was Albert Speer who became the Minister of Production for the material that they needed to wage the war. He was a remarkable man who organised things like that. And of course, Hitler had put men to work at the building of the autobahns. That employed a lot of men. And then, of course, the people's car. I've got a sketch of the design that Hitler chose for the people's car. And it's quite extraordinary how they were able to translate his sketches into the bodywork of the car. So similar to that. And of course, he wanted the people to be able to enjoy their own country. He had what was known as the Strength Through Joy movement. And the main thing was to encourage people to travel around Germany and Austria, of course, which in 1938 became part of Germany. And they also went on cruises to the Norwegian fjords and places like that. They were completely sea voyages, but they didn't land. They didn't land in the countries because the you-know-whos decided that German currency wouldn't be accepted on the international market. Oh, dear.
Wow. I heard that they weren't...
He cared about the welfare of the people. Yeah.
I heard that the Strength Through Joy ships were not allowed to dock in Britain because the British workers would see how well treated the German workers were. I hadn't heard.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about the German currency not being accepted.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's true. And that was another thing that they could see. Well, both in Italy and Germany. Because Mussolini put the men to work on completely reorganising their railways. And it was quite remarkable how they had virtually 100% railway running on time, which we could do with here
at
the moment.
Definitely.
And, big schemes like the draining of the Pontine marshes in the area of around Rome, which put an end to the mosquitoes who were carrying what does it get from a mosquito bite?
Malaria,
that's right, yeah. And so see, the first idea was to get people working and support themselves. It wasn't really a welfare state. It's just that the opportunity to work was there, and that was it. If you didn't work, you went without. If you wanted a good standard of living, well, work hard for it, which is the thing, you know, and like with their recreation, they called it the Strength Through Joy movement, where they should work hard and earn the money and take advantage of these sea cruises and trips all around Germany. To me, that's the ideal society. I can't think of anything better.
I think
where people were given the opportunity, not forced to do it, but the opportunity was there. And, of course, naturally, they wanted to, because they wanted the higher standard of living. And of course, the excuse was made, about the invasion of Poland and all that business. But that was just the an excuse for the war. It wasn't the reason why we went to war. We went to war because the National Socialist and Fascist movements were successful. And it put an end to all the big financial swindles. Things like that. That's why they wanted Germany and Italy destroyed. The devils.
Shocking. Well,
I think of my pre-war school chums and young army comrades who lost their lives believing that they were fighting to defend the society they knew and cared about. Not for any vague political slogans or anything. Each year on in November, the Remembrance, I do put a note in the local papers of in the In Memoriam columns of my friends and comrades. And it's notable, one that I include is a chap called Norman Knight, who was murdered by the Stern Gang in Palestine. And I put that in the paper, and there's one of them, the Plymouth Evening Herald, refused to put Jewish terrorists. They just said he was murdered by terrorists. They refused to use the word Jewish.
To try and cover up the identity of the terrorists and the people that murdered him.
That's right, yeah. They refused to print the word Jewish. They just said terrorists.
Things don't change, do they?
And people to wonder, well, without specifically naming who they were.
Nothing changes. Well, thank you very much for all that, Mr. I. That's fantastic. Listeners are going to love that. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.